I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 200 of my weekly radio show. Some kind of milestone, I think. The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast program. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Just remember that if you do that, you will be responsible for any long-distance charges. I don't know that you're a listener until I hear from you. Send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. And I just recently printed out a bunch of bookmarks with 2018 photographs. So they're new. They're collector's items. If you would like to sponsor this show, please contact me. You can make a one-time donation via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, or monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. That's PATREON. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. Some feedback this week on episode 199 with Mary Holland and her new book on the HPV vaccine. Joan Shenton, who's done a documentary on the HPV vaccine, wrote, "Thanks to you and Mary Holland for a brilliant, lucid, and utterly convincing interview on your Infectious Myth podcast. It's so important to get this information out, especially as this evidence is coming from a prominent lawyer." Helen, another vaccine skeptic, wrote, "Great interview and very informative book, which I have recently read." Speaking of vaccines, if you're following the news in the United States, you've probably heard about the outbreak of acute flaccid myelitis. Somebody pointed out that the symptoms are basically identical to Guillain-Barré syndrome. The only difference is that Guillain-Barré syndrome is an acknowledged side effect of vaccines. It was particularly prominent during the 1970s swine flu vaccination program, which I think created this paralysis in about 1,000 people. But of course, there's no mention of the possibility that these people, mostly children, are being paralyzed by vaccines. But somebody did point me at a 2015 British Medical Journal article on a similar outbreak, a letter by a medical insider who said, "It is taboo to suggest a role for vaccines, but some old-timers remember provocation poliomyelitis or provocation paralysis. This is paralytic polio following intramuscular injections, typically with vaccines. It was most convincingly documented by Austin Bradford Hill and Jay Noladin during the 1949 British polio epidemic, when the risk of paralytic polio was increased 20-fold among children who had received the DPT injection." Let's now go to this week's guest. Jacob Stegenga is a Cambridge University lecturer in philosophy of science. His research focuses on methodological problems of medical research, conceptual questions in evolutionary biology, and fundamental topics in reasoning and rationality. He just finished writing the book and having it published, Medical Nihilism, in which he argues that if we attend to the extent of bias in medical research, the thin theoretical basis of many interventions, the malleability of empirical methods in medicine, if we employ our best inductive framework, then our confidence in medical interventions ought to be low. His research employs empirical findings, analysis, and formal methods to establish normative conclusions about science. Before Cambridge, Dr. Stegenga received a PhD from UCSD, taught at the University of Utah and the University of Victoria, and was postdoc at the University of Toronto. Welcome to the show, Dr. Stikenga.
Thanks a lot, David, and please call me Jacob.
Okay, I will. Okay, Jacob, so nihilism, it's one of those words that I know kind of what it means, but I could never define it. So I looked it up in the dictionary, and the OED said, total rejection of current religious beliefs and moral principles. It also said an extreme form of skepticism involving the denial of all existence. You define it as the view that particularly important ideas or objects or values lack objective standing or cannot be realized. So can you kind of explain your definition and why you chose it as part of the title of your book?
Sure. So those dictionary definitions go some way towards a kind of full understanding of what the term means. Generally, there's both what you could call a metaphysical definition of nihilism and then an epistemological definition. So one way to understand what nihilism means is that there's some valuable thing that doesn't exist. Another way to understand it is there's some valuable thing, but given our limited ability to learn about the world, we can't know about that valuable thing. And then there's also a kind of emotional connotation to the term. So once we hold the view that either this valuable thing doesn't exist or we can't know about it, then the kind of emotional nihilism is, well, gosh, isn't that too bad? So that's in very general philosophical terms what the term means. I chose the term medical nihilism as a kind of summary of the big picture argument of my book, partly because of the multiple connotations of the term medical nihilism. So in different parts of the book, I'm arguing that there are these ways of thinking about medicine that we think that this kind of method of intervention exists when maybe it doesn't exist, or our methods for learning about whether or not these interventions are good or not are not nearly as reliable as we thought they were.
I just have a question. One of the things I've observed with medicine is it loves to be, well, science in general, it loves to be mathematical. So you want to be able to measure something. And often in medicine, you're measuring, say, a surrogate marker. So you measure that instead of the real thing because it's connected to the real thing. But then you focus your tests of medicines and things on the surrogate marker instead of the real thing, which means that you don't actually know if you're curing the condition at the end because you never actually tested it for that. Yeah. Is that kind of part of this picture?
That's a very important aspect of medicine today, which contributes to the overall argument. Yes. So when we go about studying whether or not some intervention does blah, 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 like lowers the risk of death by heart disease or something like that, we need to make some decisions about what to measure. And as you say, a lot of medical research chooses to measure like proxy indicators mm-hmm. of the valuable outcome of interest, right, like avoiding death. And it turns out that we have a lot of interventions that are pretty good at modulating those proxy indicators,
right,
like say cholesterol levels or blood pressure, mm-hmm. but those very same interventions are not nearly as good as modulating the really important outcomes of interest, like avoiding heart attacks and avoiding death.
Right, and I think there's examples of where they do the opposite. I think with antidepressants, it's acknowledged now that some of them increase the suicidal risk or the risk of suicidal ideation, and yet that's one of the biggest indicators of depression, right? People want to kill themselves, and so a drug that's supposed to work on depression that actually increases the risk of suicide, what you'd think would be the opposite of what you want.
That's certainly a paradox of antidepressants. That's right. Yeah.
You focus on pharmaceutical nihilism, and so why did you choose that instead of, say, surgery or radiation or other common medical interventions?
Yeah. This is a really important question. Maybe can I just say one more final
Sure.
comment about the term nihilism? So
yeah.
This is just a historical point that the term therapeutic nihilism was very popular in the 19th century. So very fashionable physicians in Boston and Paris and New York called themselves therapeutic nihilists.
Really?
Even the dean of the Harvard Medical School in the middle of the 19th century considered himself to be a therapeutic nihilist. So in one sense, I'm just kind of adopting this historical term.
But what does that mean, a therapeutic nihilist?
It means that the interventions that we have at our disposal in medicine just are far less effective than most people think they are. And in the 19th century, the view was really radical. It was they're no good at all, and we shouldn't be using them at all. Now, I don't believe that. That's I certainly don't want to say that that about all of medicine today. But it was a interesting and provocative position in the 19th century, and so I'm just kind of inheriting the term from these 19th
okay.
century physicians.
I understand it. I mean, my position is if I get hit by a bus, and I do ride my bike a lot, so I'm at risk for getting hit by something, that I definitely want to go to the emergency department. I don't think there's any better place to go after something like that.
That's exactly right. So yeah, if you're in a cycling accident and you're bleeding out, the place you exactly want to be is in the emergency department or the intensive care unit of your hospital. And so what does that little gruesome thought experiment tell us? It tells us that there are some diseases or injuries or illnesses that are amenable to interventions that we have at our disposal, and then there are some that aren't. So this gets to your question about why pharmaceutical nihilism and not, say, surgical nihilism.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one thing we all always tell our PhD students is to pick a thesis which is relatively focused and just zoom in on that.
Right.
So that's one kind of tactical reason is I don't
right.
want to take on, you know, all of medicine.
Well, medicine is a pretty huge topic, so I can appreciate
medicine
that.
Medicine is a huge, yeah, so I'm not talking really about radiology
yeah.
or vaccines or
right.
surgery. But I also think that a lot of the particular arguments that motivate the skeptical position about drugs don't apply so much to other medical modalities like surgery, say. And I could say a bit more about that if you want me to now.
Yeah, sure. I'm interested in that. I mean, I'm also mostly focused on pharmaceutical medicine because that is the dominant form of medicine these days.
Exactly.
It's the medicine outside the hospital. People come home and they take drugs.
Exactly.
So I appreciate from that point of view. But yeah, explain what you mean with surgery.
Right. So. The motivation for focusing on pharmaceuticals is exactly, as you just noted, the vast majority of consumption of medicine in its various forms occurs via pharmaceuticals. Let me give you one kind of argument from the book. So one of the chapters of the book focuses on what I call magic bullets. So I adopt this terminology from the chemist Paul Ehrlich, who invented the term magic bullets. The idea was Ehrlich wanted a kind of medical intervention which targeted diseases with
mm-hmm.
high specificity and high potency. So he wanted a drug which would just target diseases and nothing else,
right.
a magic bullet. And he's credited with discovering one of the first magic bullets. So he developed an antibiotic for syphilis. So this antibiotic, it's the first antibiotic, targeted the bacterium that causes syphilis and really only that bacterium. The treatment for syphilis before that was mercury, which was highly nonspecific and not effective. So these are magic bullets. And in the middle part of the 20th century, medicine developed many such magic bullets: penicillin, insulin mm. for type 1 diabetes, vaccines, the Salk's polio vaccine. And medicine in the last few generations has inherited this way of thinking about drugs. So we tend to think that drugs, like SSRIs, say,
mm-hmm.
are magic bullets, when there are very good reasons to think that they're not. However, if you're in a cycling accident and you're, say, you know, bleeding out by the side of the road,
right.
what you really want is somebody just to stop the blood flow.
Mm-hmm.
And stopping the blood flow is like a magic bullet. It targets
right.
the pathophysiological basis of what you're suffering from directly.
Right, and then x-rays can see very well, you know, what's broken in your body, and then you can target that if you need a pin, if it just needs to be reset, whatever. I agree. But I'm interested in Ehrlich's magic bullet, because that was actually a combination, I believe, of three metals, and one of which was arsenic. So I'm not sure, like, it's phrased as a magic bullet, but it might be specific to one bacteria, but it's also attacks the human body. And the other two components were other heavy metals. I can't remember, bismuth, I think, maybe.
Yeah. So your comment is apt. So, you know, I was giving the kind of cartoon version of that story, but it's actually the case that this first antibiotic that Ehrlich developed was toxic. It wasn't nearly as toxic as mercury, which was the treatment for syphilis at the time. And Ehrlich's antibiotic did treat syphilis very effectively, but as you say, it had arsenic in it, and so it came along with toxic side effects. It led to, within a decade or two, there was the development of less toxic antibiotics like penicillin and streptomycin. Now, what's interesting is that these are the iconic magic bullets, and they're really the most effective medical interventions that we have in medicine. But they too come along with their own kinds of problems. So a problem that we've been concerned with now for several decades is the development of antibiotic resistant organisms.
And allergic reactions. I believe that amoxicillin is the leading cause of emergency room visits due to an iatrogenic condition. So for many people, it's very effective. But if you're allergic to penicillin, it's not very good.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah. So I use drugs like this as my kind of gold standard in the book. I call them magic bullets, but that's not to say that they're perfect, of course.
Right.
But they are the kinds of interventions that medicine should be striving towards, namely interventions that cure diseases, or at least like with insulin for type 1 diabetes, are extremely effective interventions for managing symptoms of diseases, while not curing the disease, and at least have a kind of limited range of harmful side effects.
It seems one of the problems with pharmaceutical interventions is is that the major way to take a pharmaceutical is to swallow the pill. Some drugs are also injected. There may be, I guess there's rectal as well, but basically, whatever way you take the drug, it's going to diffuse through the entire body. Not the entire body, but a substantial portion of the body. If you inject it, it's the bloodstream, plus it will leak out from the bloodstream into other organs. If you swallow it, obviously it's going to also go through the whole body. So it seems somewhat like utopian to think that there can be a pharmaceutical that can suffuse through the whole body and have no side effects on anything except, say, your heart, which is where it's intended to work.
That's exactly right. And if I can add a little bit of scientific detail to that,
sure.
That'd be all right. So most drugs work as what are called ligands or exogenous ligands. So there are these, like, they're basically chemicals that come from outside the body and go inside the body, either via swallowing a pill or injection. Those ligands bind to what are called receptors. It's kind of like a lock and key. So the drug is like a lock,
right,
and unlocks the key. And when that key is unlocked, it turns up or turns down biochemical pathways.
Right.
And those biochemical pathways, either activated or inactivated, have physiological effects. So it turns out that many drugs, if not most drugs, have a one-to-many relationship between the drug and
right.
the receptors that they bind to.
Right.
And then there's a one-to-many relationship between activated receptor and activated biochemical pathway.
Right.
And then there's a one-to-many relationship between activated biochemical pathway and physiological effects. So there's this, like, cascading complexity of effects of these drugs and a kind of washing out. So a metaphor that I like is, imagine a big waterfall, like,
right,
you know, Niagara Falls, say.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some fish swimming at the bottom of the waterfall, and you want to get it a glass of wine. And so you go to the top of the waterfall and you pour the glass of wine into the waterfall.
Right.
And you ask how much wine are you going to get to the fish. So this kind of metaphor is Yeah. It was meant to
understand. Yes. Yeah. Like none, basically. But I mean, even if the drug and a ligand, I think that we have things like ligatures to tie, right? The ligand means it ties with something else. So even if, you know, drug A ties most strongly with one ligand, there will be others that it ties to, you're saying, maybe not as strongly, but that's where you're probably going to get your side effects coming from. And so this, looking for a magic bullet in that kind of environment, you'd have to be very lucky to find a drug that only connected with one chemical inside the body, and that chemical only had one, you know, one beneficial impact.
This is exactly right. So, for instance, SSRIs modulate a particular kind of receptor for serotonin, but it turns out that they bind to many other kinds of receptors, mm-hmm. which are found all throughout the body, not just your brain, but, you know, your gut, all different, many different organs, and those different receptors have a wide range of physiological, downstream physiological effects.
Right. I mean, when I look at side effects for drugs, you often see that the side effects affect a lot of different organs in the body. It's not as if a heart drug just has side effects on the heart. It might have side effects on the liver. It might damage the nervous system, things like that.
Can I say a few words about side effects? Right. We have a lot of empirical evidence that drugs have a wide range of side effects. Many drugs today on the label for the drug, there's, you know, hundreds of different side effects that are listed.
Mm-hmm.
However, in one chapter of the book, I argue that even despite this empirical evidence, the empirical evidence drastically underestimates the real harms. And that's for a variety of reasons that have to do with the way randomized trials are designed mm-hmm. to test the effects of interventions. So the short story is, randomized trials, which are held to be like the gold standard for testing the effects of interventions,
right.
Randomized trials are designed in a multitude of ways to be sensitive to detecting the benefits of interventions at the expense of detecting the harms of interventions. And so this leaves open the very real possibility that there are many harms of drugs that are simply going undetected in trials.
Right. So, for example, if you were testing, I mean, it's just, don't care about the condition. You're testing a new drug. You're probably going to look to test it on like moderately aged adults. You're not going to test it on children. You're not going to test it on old people. You're not going to test it on people who are already sick. Right, so that's already a very different population, and your target population may actually be people who are sick, but you might not test it on
exactly
those people.
Yeah, so this is one of the many reasons why trials are not catching harm. So they exclude subjects, as you say, who are sick with other diseases or are on multiple other drugs or are elderly. Many women are excluded from trials, but we know that it tends to be people who are older and on multiple drugs and have multiple diseases who tend to consume new drugs at a higher frequency. But we also have empirical reasons to know that it's those very factors that modulate the benefit-harm profile of drugs. So mm-hmm. elderly people tend to be harmed by drugs more than healthy middle-aged people.
Right, which only makes sense. I mean, not only may their body be less resistant to the benefits of the drugs, it may be more fragile and more likely to experience the side effects more severely. You also talk about money. I don't think you can talk about medicine without talking about money. Mm-hmm. And you also talked about doctors in England, anyway, and I think this is probably true everywhere, liking new drugs. Mm-hmm. I think those two things are related. You agree that new drugs are more heavily marketed, is more benefits for the doctor?
Sure, definitely. So, and the affection for new drugs, this kind of novelty bias in medicine, isn't merely on the part of physicians. I mean, you know, patients too have a motivation to get the latest and the greatest, even if it's not so great. So there is a novelty bias.
I guess it's like, you know, buying a new car, you want all these new these new gimmicks, but you know, maybe the cars from 10 years ago were built better. But you know, in your mind, it's got to be, it's new. I want all the new things. It's better. So we have financial incentives to have new drugs. You have just like the whole bias towards novelty. I mean, are there reasons for? You said, for example, of the 10 top selling drugs in Britain, 8 were introduced in the previous decade.
Yeah.
So are there other reasons why people choose new drugs, even if they're not really better?
Well, you mentioned marketing, and you mentioned the importance of financial incentives. So the biggest financial incentive today in medicine is, strictly speaking, outside the clinic. So the biggest financial incentive today, where the most money is made in modern medicine, is in the pharmaceutical industry itself. So there are, you know, many hundreds of billions of dollars to be made by industry selling new drugs. Now, of course, there's a financial incentive on the part of, say, physicians, and there's a in the United States, there's a financial incentive in place for health insurance companies. But these are the financial incentives for individual physicians they're important, and they play a big role in prescription practices and in the kind of guideline advice that is published for medicine. But the biggest and arguably most pervasive and nefarious financial incentive comes via the pharmaceutical industry. And one reason why this is the case is that the vast majority of research on new drugs is done by the pharmaceutical companies that manufacture those drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a direct conflict of interest in getting their drugs to look more effective and safer than they truly are.
And the financial incentive for new drugs for the pharmaceutical companies was created by government through patents. And in the United States, I don't know if it's true elsewhere, they have something called exclusive marketing rights, which are in addition to the patent. So that is a huge incentive. You can sell a drug for 10 times as much money or more if you're the sole holder of the patent. But if it's a 50-year-old drug, anybody can make it.
Yes, that's exactly right. So in the Western jurisdictions that I'm familiar with, like the United States, companies have 20 years of patent protection in typical cases. After the but during that 20 years, that includes the research time, at least the clinical research time on the drug. So once you have a drug on patent with patent protection, you can start testing it on humans. And typically that takes about 10 years. So companies have about remaining 10 or 12 years to really make money off of their new drug. And as you say, they're able to charge pretty much what they want, although there's a lot of negotiation with you know, socialized healthcare systems. But typically that's where they make their most money, and a single drug can bring in multiple billions of dollars per year for a company.
You said that insurance companies had a motivation to support new drugs. Why is that? Because they're more expensive.
So let me back up on this claim briefly. So insurance companies have a variety of incentives. One is to really follow the guidelines carefully, because insurance companies and private hospitals and the physicians that work for them don't want to be sued for malpractice.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So if there's a guideline in place for treating a patient of a particular kind, then there's an incentive to just follow that guideline.
Right.
That guideline very often is prescribe this medication or that medication. Now, in some cases, insurance companies have a countervailing motivation. They want to not pay for treatments that don't work.
Mm-hmm.
And so this happens sometimes. There are cases in which a new trial or meta-analysis will be published that shows that an intervention which has been paid for a long time by an insurance company actually turns out to be ineffective, or no better than placebo, or no better than, say, exercise, if you're talking about, say, a knee procedure. And then the company can just choose to stop funding treatment for that intervention, stop paying for that intervention.
Mm-hmm.
So this does happen sometimes, although it doesn't happen nearly as much as I think it should. And it's not just insurance companies that should be making decisions like this. It's also organizations like in the United Kingdom, it's NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, which publishes guidance on what kinds of treatments should be paid for by socialized healthcare systems.
I wanted to talk about the issue of placebos in trials. And I've observed more recently that there's lots of cases where the placebo is a previous intervention as opposed to a true placebo, which is, you know, something that has no biological effect on the human. And so if the previous intervention has side effects, then the clinical trial will basically mask those side effects, right? You know, if you have 10 heart attacks on the placebo and 10 heart attacks on the active drug, but actually the placebo is an active drug, you don't really know if those 10 heart attacks are just random events or if they're actually caused by both drugs.
That's right, yeah. And
so can you say more about the issue of a placebo in the randomized controlled trials? Did you find other issues?
Sure, yeah. So you're putting your finger on this question raises a whole host of important questions. As most people know, the placebo effect is the elicitation of various effects by consuming an intervention where those effects aren't biochemically caused by the active ingredient of the mm-hmm. drug, but rather they arise due to expectation effects or mm-hmm. the mere process of being treated or getting attention. And it turns out that many diseases are very placebo responsive. So, for instance, depression turns out to be a very placebo-responsive disease, whereas type 1 diabetes is not very placebo-responsive mm-hmm. at all. Mm-hmm. You can trick people into feeling better with placebos and depression, but you can't trick a diabetic's body into producing more insulin.
Right. That makes sense.
Now, when it comes to designing trials, there are a few principles that have been operative for a number of decades. One is we need to control for this placebo effect. So we can't just give subjects in a trial the intervention and not compare how they do to subjects not getting the intervention
right.
because we know about the placebo effect. Okay, so we need some control group. So what should we give people in the control group? Some people argue we should give them placebos. Inactive medications so that exactly
right.
we can subtract out the difference between the active part of the mm-hmm. intervention and the placebo part. Other people say, well, if we already have an existing medication on the market,
mm-hmm.
then the control group should get the existing medication and the experimental group of the trial should get the new drug. And that's in part for ethical reasons, because if we have some drug that we know works a little bit, then we shouldn't deny
right.
the people in the control group some helpful intervention. But that practice raises the problem that you started the question with, namely, if there's some harmful effect caused by the intervention, then you're going to elicit that effect in the control group. And if it's a similar kind of intervention, then you'll mm. then you might elicit that harmful effect in the experimental group as well.
And if there have been, if medical science was perfect and so approved drugs were always perfect, then that logic would apply. But first of all, we know there's problems with science. And secondly, we know that drugs are approved, even though it's known that they produce side effects. And so I guess in the case where the new drug has less side effects, you might have, say, 10 heart attacks in the old drug and 3 with the new drug, you know, that might tell you, okay, this is really better than the old drug. But the placebo would tell you whether maybe even the new drug is still eliciting more heart attacks than if you didn't take anything. You just don't know that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah. So there are active debates among medical scientists and philosophers of medicine about whether or not we should be using placebo-controlled trials or active controls. And for reasons like this, I think that there's a case to be made that we should be using placebo-controlled trials.
Yes. Another thing you bring up, which is I think is talked about a lot in the medical community, but not well known outside, and that's publication bias, which I think is related to also meta-analysis. So do you want to talk about that for a bit?
Sure, yeah. So publication bias is a really simple idea. The basic idea is that research projects that support one's favored hypothesis or support some company's new intervention, those research projects tend to get published, whereas those research projects that don't support one's favored hypothesis or one's new medical intervention tend not to get published. So a company who has a new drug under patent can do 10 randomized control trials, and if two of them support the drug, then those two will get published and the remaining eight won't get published. And it turns out that publication bias is a really widespread phenomenon in clinical research today. And it doesn't take rocket science to see that publication bias, if you just look at the published record, the phenomenon of publication bias entails that the available evidence about a new drug will systematically overestimate the effectiveness of that drug and systematically underestimate the harm.
Right. It seemed for a while that meta-analysis was seen as this amazing thing, this amazing tool that you could take all these little trials and put them together and draw a much more statistically powerful conclusion. And from a statistician's point of view, it makes sense. But if you're not including, as you say, the unpublished science, the work that was done and completed but came to a negative conclusion, and therefore there was less incentive on everybody's part to publish it, it can draw the wrong conclusion. And this was an issue. I don't know if you've been following the Cochrane Institute sort of scandal with Peter Gottschalk, because this was one of the issues that there was a study, I think, on the HPV vaccine that only basically included the published data. And Gottschalk said, you only included half the studies, and came to a big fight. Do you have anything to say on this scandal?
Definitely. Well, let me say something about the general idea and then maybe a word or two about the current scandal. I haven't been keeping up with it on a day-to-day basis, but I know the rough outline. So in brief, as you've already mentioned, meta-analysis is this technique that is supposed to bring together all of the available trials that are about some intervention. So if we want to test whether or not some antidepressant actually is effective, then rather than look at the results of one trial, we should just look at the results of all of the available trials on that antidepressant. And you've noted that there's this worry that publication bias will mean that many meta-analyses are misleading because they're only looking at the published data. But some scientists are able to get both published and unpublished data. So via a variety of means, sometimes using like legal tactics, or sometimes using regulatory muscle to force the hand of private industry, sometimes scientists are able to get, if not all of the unpublished data, at least some of the unpublished data. And then a meta-analysis is much more reliable.
Right.
Because it addresses this problem of systematic overestimation of effects and systematic underestimation of harms. What's interesting is there are a number of very famous meta-analyses about very high-profile drugs that follow this method, that get access to both published and unpublished data. And those meta-analyses have, on the whole, given us a rather dim view about really widely used interventions. And the scandal that you're referring to is exactly a case in point. So
I interviewed Eric Turner. I don't know if you know him. A couple of years ago, he used to work for the FDA. And then he went to work for Veterans Affairs Hospitals or something like that. But he was very interested in this, but he knew how to find the data that the FDA made public, but in a very obscure location, so that if you went looking for the data, you normally wouldn't find it. And he had an effort underway to try to make more of this available to scientists, because like you, he recognized that this secrecy is a problem. There was also a similar situation in Canada where a doctor was trying to get this evidence from Health Canada, which is our regulator, and the regulator was refusing to provide it. I mean, it seems like the regulators are often cooperating in the secrecy of this data.
Yes, there are some high-profile cases in which that seems to be exactly the case. I'll just describe one example briefly. There was a drug, rosiglitazone, which was a drug for type 2 diabetes. It was widely prescribed, manufactured by GlaxoSmithKline. Mm-hmm. And starting in the early 2000s, some diabetes researchers started to wonder, is this causing heart attacks? We had little reports here or there, conference proceedings, that maybe this is causing heart attacks. There are a bunch of small trials, and no individual trial showed that there was a heart attack, an increase in heart attacks caused by this drug, rosiglitazone. But then a prominent type 2 diabetes researcher, Steve Nissen, did a meta-analysis, and he asked GlaxoSmithKline for all of the data, published and unpublished. And guess what? GlaxoSmithKline said no.
That was my guess.
But what's interesting was GlaxoSmithKline had gone through a big legal battle a few years prior, mm-hmm. because they'd basically been deceiving the regulators and the public about the safety of one of their other drugs.
Right.
And a conclusion of this legal battle was that GlaxoSmithKline had to make all of their data publicly available. So Nissen went through this route and got access to data on 42 trials. About one third of them had been published and two thirds had not been published. Nissen analyzed all the data, and it turned out that rosiglitazone was increasing risk of heart attack by something like 43%. Mm-hmm. Now, here's where things get interesting. Nissen submitted the manuscript to a journal, the New England Journal of Medicine, and one of the peer reviewers faxed a copy to GlaxoSmithKline. And then there were a series of memos that went around.
Wow.
a series of memos went around at GlaxoSmithKline, and one executive said to another, Nissen has just found out what we already knew at GlaxoSmithKline and what the FDA had known. So some journalists got access to these memos, and they tried to piece the story together. Basically, what had happened was GlaxoSmithKline had done their own internal meta-analysis, and they found an increase in the risk of heart attacks. And they told the FDA about it, and the FDA did their own meta-analysis, and they found an increase in the risk of heart attacks, but this was never published. So years went by where both GlaxoSmithKline and the FDA
knew,
had access to all of this data, and it took Nissen's publication to really expose the harms of these drugs. Then, a couple of years later, an epidemiologist at the FDA calculated how many heart attacks had been caused in those intervening years, and it was something like 70,000 or 80,000. 80,000
heart
attacks.
Wow.
So it's a case in which, it looked like the regulator was being silent.
I mean, I understand how financial incentives blind the drug company. I mean, human greed, and, it's very easy. You're surrounded by people who all think the same, and you just kind of don't think about it too much. I mean, that's a lot of dead people. But it's harder to understand how the regulator could do that. I mean, do you know if the meta-analysis was published, and then higher-ups said, or pardon me, the meta-analysis was completed, and higher-ups said, we're not going to make this public? Or why did it not become public information?
I'm a philosopher of science by training, not a sociologist. So I can only sort of speculate about what's happening. So, but there are sociological theories about regulators. There's one prominent theory called regulatory capture, where the idea is regulators have a kind of revolving door with industry. So you work in a regulator for a while, then you work in industry for a while. So there's this notion of regulatory capture that staff at regulatory agencies don't want to ruffle the feathers of industry too much. Regulators are also political bodies. So the chief of the FDA is an appointment by the president of the United States. And so, so clearly pharmaceutical companies are involved in, say, campaign financing. And so these are both, there's economic incentives and political incentives. There's also one theory about regulators is that once once a new drug has been approved, the regulator has a disincentive to pull it from the market or to expose harms caused by the drug, because that would amount to admitting that they made a big, big mistake. So there are different kinds of sociological theories about regulatory failure in general. My interest as a philosopher of science is basically describing the kind of scientific conditions under which those kinds of failures can occur.
Right, right. I mean, it's a huge area. I understand also, this is a memory from years ago, that the conflict of interest rules at the FDA don't apply to the highest levels, because they said we can't get people at that level if we look for conflicts of interest, because they've all worked for the big drug companies. So they all have a built-in conflict of interest. I hope you don't mind if I keep switching subjects here on my,
sure,
on my list of things.
Sure.
So you talked about the Hamilton rating scale for depression, and how that ended up ignoring an increased risk of suicidal ideation. So do you know what I'm talking about?
Sure. Yeah. Of course. So this is a interesting episode. And it touches on a lot of the things that we've already been discussing. So briefly, around 2000, there was some suggestion that antidepressants were increasing suicidal ideation and suicidal behavior. But there wasn't any very clear evidence about it.
Mm-hmm.
Famously in Canada, the University of Toronto offered a job to David Healy.
Yes.
And David Healy, at his inaugural lecture, talked about this hypothesis, and then his job was revoked a few weeks later, and it turns out that the center that hired him gets, you know, many millions of dollars from the manufacturer of one of these drugs. So a meta-analysis was performed in which the result was that these antidepressants do not, in fact, increase suicidal ideation or behavior. This meta-analysis was a meta-analysis of the available randomized control trials, in which the main measuring device that was used was the Hamilton Rating Scale for Depression.
Mm-hmm.
So should we believe that meta-analysis or shouldn't we? Well, here's the thing. This measuring scale, it's a 17-question survey. Each question has three or four possible answers. You get a certain number of points depending on your answer to a particular question.
Right.
And then total number of points is summed. And the total score is around 50. And so it's supposed to be a measure of the severity of your depression. And so what you want in a trial is to show that the intervention group, their HAM-D score goes down more than the control group.
Right.
There's one single question on the HAM-D score, on the HAM-D scale, about suicidality.
Right.
So one out of these 17 questions is about suicide. There's four possible answers, and they're kind of confusing, muddled ideas, the particular answers, and the differences between like a 0-point answer and a 1-point answer are huge.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, you get 0 points if you have no suicidal ideation or behavior whatsoever, and you get 1 point if you think about suicide.
Okay.
there's a big difference.
And you still have other answers, like maybe if you've attempted suicide or...
Exactly. Like if you've actively harmed yourself, then you get 4 points. Now, I forget the particular details, but the general point is there's one question on the HAM-D score with these really crude, coarse-grained, a coarse-grained scoring system.
Right.
We have four possible points. And so this meta-analysis was a meta-analysis of that one question.
Right.
Now, the general idea is that question is simply insensitive to subtle changes in suicidal ideation or behavior. You know, people can go from a little bit suicidal to a little bit more suicidal to even a little bit more suicidal, and this coarse-grained 4-point question is just insensitive to detecting those changes.
I see.
Yeah. And a meta-analysis just inherits that problem rather than solves the problem.
Right. So if you were, I mean, I guess I don't know what the scale is, but let's say for argument's sake that it's that zero is, you know, you never thought about suicide. One is you think about it. Two is you've tried or something like that. Then you could go from you think about it once a month to you think about it all the time and still be in number one on that scale.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly. Now, okay. We don't need to. I've got it in front of me if you want me to.
Yeah, sure. If you can. This. Yeah.
Okay. So here it is. Okay. So the question on suicidality is scored as follows. Zero equals absent. So you have no suicidality, but you get 0 points. You get 1 point if you feel like life is not worth living.
Right.
Just imagine that difference, going from zero to one.
Right.
You have no suicidal behavior. If you feel like life is not worth living, you get 1 point. That's a huge difference. Yeah. You get 2 points if you wish you were dead or you had any thoughts of possible death to self.
Right.
Three if you have suicidal ideas or gestures. And four if you actually attempt suicide. So these are it's a confusing set of categories, right? So if you think about the difference between one and two, it's sort of hard to tell the difference between what is a one and one is a two. One is you feel like life is not worth living. Two is you wish you were dead. Well, those are kind of the same, right?
Well,
so the difference between one and two is very tiny, whereas the difference between zero and one is huge.
Well, I mean, the way I would look at it is that if you did a scale from zero to 100, absence is zero, and feel life is not worth living is like a 90.
Yeah.
And wish you were dead is a 95.
Exactly.
I see your point. So they've taken this linear scale, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, but what you would logically say that the severity of those things doesn't fit that linear scale.
Exactly, yeah. And that general issue is something that is not talked about nearly enough in medicine in general and in psychiatry in particular, namely the validity of measuring tools that are used in trials. So,
well, pretty much all of psychiatry is based on this kind of thing. Right, it's either a doctor's, a psychiatrist's opinion about you, or you answer a bunch of questions and they score the questions. Very little what you might think of as scientific measurements, right?
That's true for a lot of clinical research. There are, of course, really compelling counterexamples. So, for instance, here's one outcome that is the most objective outcome we can imagine in a clinical trial, whether or not a person lives or dies. Yeah, so there's no subjectivity about that whatsoever. So this person is alive, this person is dead. For a lot of the interventions that are being used today with the aim of avoiding death, namely like statins, blood pressure-lowering drugs, when trials use this super objective outcome, namely, did these people live or die, it turns out that the effect size of these interventions is absolutely minuscule.
Mm-hmm.
So when we have objective markers used in trials, the effects of these drugs look really, really small.
Right. Okay, we're kind of running out of time, but I wanted to ask you about some questions you made about psychiatry. You talk about an anti-psychiatry movement, and you also said, I do not align myself with these views. So you're sort of very skeptical, you're very critical of psychiatric medical research and the benefits of interventions. So what is your difference between yourself and, say, somebody like Healy and Gottschy, who could be considered in the anti-psychiatry movement, or maybe you don't consider them in it?
Okay, good question. So the anti-psychiatry movement was really an important thing in the 1960s and 70s, and it was aligned with all sorts of beliefs, not just about psychiatry, but about society in general. So one famous argument for the anti-psychiatry movement was called the sick society argument. The idea was, it's not these schizophrenic patients who are sick, it's society which is sick. And right, there's this kind of 21st century version of and the anti-psychiatry movement, which is focused really on both the disease categories themselves. Like some critics say, most cases of depression aren't real depression, they're just kind of suburban sadness, that kind of criticism. And then other critics are worried about the drugs themselves. So people like David Healy. I know David Healy. He and I have spoken about this quite a lot. I guess he would consider himself, although he's a psychiatrist, he would consider himself an anti-psychiatrist.
Right.
I'm not sure how helpful this label is for the cluster of problems that we are worried about now. So there are certain things that psychiatry can do that are really important. So if you have a psychotic patient who is, hearing voices and speaking in tongues and it's hurting himself or hurting other people, then we have some interventions that can at least try to modulate that.
I think there are some critics of psychiatry who see the whole thing as broken, and you're saying that you see parts of it as good, but you recognize that there's other parts that are broken or seriously or overrated, such as antidepressants.
So that's roughly right. I wouldn't say that there are parts of psychiatry that are especially good. I would say that the best that we've got now is maybe better than nothing. For some areas of psychiatry, especially psychosis, and then other areas of psychiatry, the whole thing looks broken. And unfortunately, that's like the vast majority of modern day consumption of psychiatry is basically in the suburbs. It's in the clinic. It's not in these critical care contexts, and that's where it really looks like psychiatry is broken for all the reasons we've talked about today.
Yes. Well, thank you for sharing your book Medical Nihilism with me. My impression of the book was the first maybe two-thirds of the book was pretty accessible for anybody who's got some tolerance for scientific arguments, a little bit of math. The last part of the book gets a lot more technical. I found.
Thanks for saying that. Yeah, although chapter 12 is the final chapter, and that chapter was meant to be a kind of like sum up the view and ask the kind of questions like, okay, if medical nihilism is even a little bit compelling, what should we do about clinical practice, clinical research, regulation? And that was a kind of like hopefully an accessible wrap up. And I have heard from a bunch of physicians and patients who have read the book, and I've gotten a lot of sort of positive feedback about the accessibility of it.
I think the even if you can't wade through the math, I think the book is worth it for the majority of it that is written at the level of a well-educated and thoughtful person. So I think it's an important addition to the large library of books that are critical of pharmaceutical medicine.
Thanks for saying that.
Yes. So, Jacob, thank you very much for joining me today, and I will send you a link to the podcast when it's up in a few days.
Thanks so much. It's been a really fun conversation, and I'm delighted to have such a close reading of the book. So thanks, David.
Okay. Goodbye then.
Yeah. So bye. Yep. Bye.
Yep. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to episode 200 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.